Welcome to the latest Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
I'll give you another
and call. Welcome to Serotalk Tech Chat 60 for April 26, 2010. This is Michael Loft. A topic I think will be very well received, something that many people are very passionate about. We're going to talk today about guide dogs specifically, and we will delineate the difference between service animals because there are many different types of service animals. And we have three guests with us this evening to help assist with that. We have, from the Serotech staff, we have Mr. Buddy Brannon, who is working on his third guide dog and has attended two different schools, and we'll give that perspective about the differences in training techniques and rules and going through the motions there at schools. Also, SAMNet member Jenny Quick, who's on her second guide dog named Chloe, and joining us out in Oregon, we have Tammy Smith-Kinney, who actually trained her own animals, and that was totally foreign to me, but it's a much larger number of people than we would realize who do that. And we'll be very excited to hear her stories and learning experiences where all of that is concerned. So I'll give each of you a little chance to kind of introduce yourself. And maybe the first question is to, I'll start with Buddy. I want to say, how has having the guide dog changed your life? What do you do different, or what were you afraid to do before you had the animal, or what was its significance to you? And as I ask you those three that question, I'm going to show a blog post today by Serotech CEO Mike Calvo, a very compelling story about how partnering with his guide dog Jackson has dramatically changed his life. And but Buddy, go ahead and just talk about kind of life before and after the dog, kind of what changes you had to make in your life and the independence it's offered you.
Okay, well, I'm kind of an odd case, I guess, because I don't know that I've really noticed until after being between dog two and dog three, like I am right now. But really, before and after, I didn't do any more or any less. Ironically, I probably did more traveling outside of my home area before I got a dog than I did after. But I think that's more due to life circumstance than anything else. I've never been afraid to go anywhere or do much of anything. Just with the cane, I took a month-long cultural exchange trip to Germany, and I traveled all over the country for different things and so forth. But there are a lot of things, and like I said, I think I'm noticing it more after having used a guide dog for about 13 years, but there's a lot more stuff that's just easier. Getting across big open parking lots is a lot easier. Like if you get out of the car, if you've got a general idea of which direction the door that you want to go to is, you can sort of point yourself in that direction and your dog will pretty much zero in on the door. Whereas, you know, with the cane, you have to sort of find the edge of the parking lot and trail around the parking lot and eventually get to where you're going. And it's something you can do, but it's not easy.
Right, a lot of things like hotel rooms and mailboxes and just a lot of landmarks.
Yeah. Well, that kind of stuff, some of that stuff is actually harder with the dog because you don't have that immediate feedback, right? So, like if you get directions to take the fourth sidewalk on the left, that's a little bit harder to do with your dog until your dog knows that route, and then it's a breeze. But the same thing with hotel rooms. Of course, both of my dogs have always taken me to the one right before the one right after for the first several times.
Mileage varies because I remember we were at ACB. I'm going to come up to the hotel room and show you one of the benefits of having the dog, how that dog's going to hone right in, not only find my hotel room but find yours as well. So, uh-huh. And those things vary. But Jenny, what is having the dog meant to you? How has it changed your life?
Obviously the responsibility part of it, you know, because my dog is a morning dog and I am not a morning person, and my dog likes to get up early. And that's one thing you have to, you know, that change, you know, obviously you have to get up and, you know, if you stay up all night partying, and you still got to get up and take your dog out the next day. Or
no more sleep until noon, huh?
Yeah. Well, you can. You just have to go. You just have to get up and take your dog out, and then go back to bed. But I mean, obviously, you have the added responsibility. I mean, I hear people say, "Well, you can't just throw your dog in the corner of the room," and that's one reason why some people don't want the dog is because of the added responsibility. But having said all that, I think that it's completely outweighed by the dog. As I said, the dog can do things like that a cane cannot do. For example, one big example I had the other day, a few weeks ago, is I was getting ready to cross the street, and I told my dog Ford. And a car was coming, and it was one of those newer cars that don't make a lot of noise. And I didn't hear it. And I have pretty decent hearing, you know, but she, I guess, could see it and didn't move. And, of course, as soon as, like, the split second that it told that I kind of was thinking, why isn't she going, was enough time for me to realize that, oh, wait, here comes the car. Because then I could hear it when it was right there. I could hear it. So the dog will notice things in a farther distance and in a wider field.
Or windy days. I could think of days 50, 60 mile an hour winds where you cannot hear any vehicle.
You can't hear anything. Yeah, and your dog just keeps right on going. I've had that happen to me also where the wind was blowing really hard and I couldn't hear the cars and she would, you know, not go if they were coming. So, and also like cracks in the sidewalk, which for me using a cane, I get so frustrated. Your cane gets stuck in every little crack and crevice, and you there's cracks and crevices you never knew existed, you know, if you had a dog, whereas the dog just breezes you right by them. Although, as Buddy said, the drawback to that is if you're trying to learn a route, sometimes if you're trying to learn a route, you might want to take your cane with you so that you can teach your dog certain things, but then once they learn it, you may not need, I mean, sometimes you use the cane and the dog in conjunction, but I think the biggest change is just having the freedom of movement and the not having to stop every time your cane gets stuck in something or whatever, you know, once you know where you're going, the dog just goes. And of course, when you're with other people, if your dog is really good at following people, you can just tell your dog follow and you don't have to hold on to anyone's arm. You know, unless, like, say, if you're in a crowded area or whatever. But, I mean, generally, if you say, you know, follow, and if your dog's good at that, you just follow the group of people you're with. And as long as they communicate to you where they are, and you keep your dog, you know, that way you know if they're turning or if they're going into a different room or whatever. It's just a lot more independence and freedom of movement than you get.
My dog always tries to follow from the front.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Tammy, I want to turn to you because your experience is unique. You trained your own dog, so I assume there you've never attended any of the schools, so you had to develop your knowledge of what the animals can do. So talk about kind of when you began training animals and kind of how you got to where you are today.
Okay. Well, I grew up on a cattle ranch, really, so I had animals around all the time. So, you know, and I was kind of working with them and training them, and they were training me more when I was, you know, a child. But, and I got interested enough. I did a lot of horse training, and I would, you know, train the dogs around the ranch to do this and that. It was never useful, but we all had fun. You know, so I read about operant conditioning and various training methods, and I've trained various animals, usually for myself over the years. I enjoy it. I enjoy the interaction and enjoy having an animal who that interacts with me. I've also rehabbed a bunch of animals, so and that's a different thing. When I lost my vision, I used a cane for several years, and I was living, oddly enough, back out not too far from the old ranch, even though I'd, you know, lived in cities and stuff, and there were not services or mobility training there. So I taught myself to use a cane. I was able to pick up tips and tricks and had intended to get a guide dog, but in the meantime was injured about the arms and hands, and anyway, there was an attack. So that took a toll on my health, and it turned out that using the cane just aggravated the injuries. So I was not in a position to go to a guide dog school, and needed to get out and walk and not use the cane. So that was rather odd. So in that sense, the dog did change my life because at first getting out and walking again was very painful and exhausting and not pleasant, but it was more fun with the dog.
So how did you feel comfortable enough to say, well, I can't go to school, but I think I know enough about dogs and their capabilities? I assume you had a network of people. I mean, what made you feel comfortable enough to do that, or did you start in very small, less populated areas, or how did you approach this?
Well, I wanted a dog anyway, and because I've been interested in training and knew at some point I would be blind and needing a guide dog, or at least wanting one, it's something I've thought about off and on. I probably would not have chosen to own or train my first had I not needed one quickly to keep walking, and had some confidence in my training ability, and I found the right dog. And I was very fortunate there also. And so she's worked out quite well.
And how much time did that training take? I mean, that's not a...
From socialization, now I got her at 7 months and she had no prior training. She had grown up, I call her a free range poodle. I got her from the breeder and she had grown up, with a large pack of dogs and stuff on some property, and had interacted with people but had no training at all, which seemed like a good idea. I next time would go a bit younger. Or get an older that had the basic obedience training. But anyway, I'm sorry, I was thinking about that. And
I was just trying to get an idea. We're talking like couple years, or just basically the time to get up to speed.
Right. So from the time I declared her, obviously I got her at 7 months. Now, and I consider the training to be everything I did, as up until we started the actual guide dog training and that completed. I considered her training done officially when she was 2. So that was almost 18 months.
Okay.
She had been working on a limited basis. I wasn't asking her to take full responsibility by that point. And we were doing a lot of refining. I thought of her as an apprentice. Even before that. But I wanted to wait till she was 2 just because of the maturity. So that's about a 15-month process. It can take up to 2 years. A lot depends on the dog and when you get them. The shortest figure that I have heard of for owner training a guide dog is 4 months.
Wow, 4 months. That's
right, but that's usually
assumes like a lot of prior...
A lot of obedience, right, training already came into play.
Right, which does help. And I know several people who have gotten really good dogs of the right age to start the guide dog training because they already have a good foundation. Now, you still, because of the work a guide dog does in public and so forth, you do need to spend some time before you put them in harness and teach them those skills to socialize them and, to go in stores, to deal with crowds, to deal with people, wanting to pet them all the time and that sort of thing. And that also gives you an opportunity to observe the dog because the dog has to have the temperament to be able to work and deal with those distractions.
Right, to acknowledge them, but then ultimately ignore them and keep mind on task, right? So I got a few questions. I do want to kind of move around here, and I'll just throw these out and let anyone answer them. First one, maybe a little bit more for Buddy and Jenny. So you make the decision, hopefully you understand the commitments of lifestyle, the changes. You're not going to be sleeping till noon anymore. At least you're going to be getting up somewhere in that mix. But choosing your guide dog school, I assume a lot of people the first time may just go with a recommendation. People they talk to say, yeah, I got my dog from this school and it was a great school. I got an email from Michael Evers who made some very good points talking about not only knowing your lifestyle and thinking about incidents where a cane might be better, such as an amusement park or a loud concert or something that might be really distracting to the dogs, or some people have had concerns about like going to a horse race or a zoo or something that they weren't sure how their animals were going to react, so they kept them out of those environments. But so one of the things that he said was his feeling was that if you're going to go with one of these schools, stay with something that is one of the schools, one of the 60 schools that is a member of the International Guide Dog Federation, and they have 60 schools, and I've got those links here. Number one is a link to that. Yeah, dog's got some comments too there, I think. So they got
some, the routine.
There you go.
Anyway, go ahead.
But they have the United States members schools. That's link number three. And not all schools are listed on there. So, again, that's not our opinion. That's just who some people feel that you should attend an accredited school. Now, here's a what I believe more comprehensive if you want to know. And, again, I can't vouch for that. I haven't done that much research. But this is a list from the GDUI, the Guide Dog Users, Inc., a list of U.S. schools. So, but one of the things he talked about, and I like your comments on this, is how do you find out, he says you should find out about a school's breeding programs, their qualification processes for guide dogs, the admission procedures. So I'm wondering, you know, and the reputation of the school itself. Now, of course, some schools have gone through periods of time where they developed a negative reputation but have gotten their act together, either had some short-term or temporary bad management. But I'd be curious from you, Jenny or Buddy, any comments on, are these things you thought about, or maybe you thought about a little bit more in your second school versus the first? Or, Jenny, I know you attended the same school, but did you give a lot of consideration to those factors?
I didn't, not at first. I kind of thought, oh, well, you know, I'm going to one of the larger schools. It's got a good reputation. It has weather that is sort of close to what I live with myself, and pretty much left it at that. And the second time, you know, again, I went with one of the larger schools, you know, based on reputation and talking to different people and so forth. And some of that kind of, and those are all good points, you know, to check out the breeding program and check out as much as you can. Don't be afraid to ask anything. Don't be afraid to ask anything of the admission staff or anybody that you can get a hold of. I'm not
exactly. This is a big commitment.
I'm not convinced that the international certification is. I mean, it's. I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm not convinced that it's the be all and end all either.
All right, that argument about accreditation has been argued for years. Someone said, well, it's some standards, but you're right. Yeah, I mean, someone could be accredited and still not be up to par, and there may be schools that haven't acquired that accreditation that may still be very, very fine institutions. And that's why link I posted does, at least for the states, you know, have the schools. And, of course, the links are there for our international audience as well. But I was just...
Definitely, you know, look at all that stuff because it's important. You're talking about a partnership that is going to last for several years, and you're talking about your safety here.
Right. You're putting your life to an extent in that dog's hands. Obviously, you're making the ultimate decisions, but you know, when you're crossing a street that you don't hear a dangerous situation or
hear the car. I was just going to say
loose manhole cover or anything. Yeah, Jenny, your thoughts? Yeah.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I was just going to say really probably didn't give as much thought to it or ask as many questions the first time as I probably should have, because I was a lot younger then, and I just went with, you know, I asked questions of the people that actually went to the school, and that's where I got a lot of my information. I really didn't think about, it just never occurred to me to ask a lot to, like breeding, I never thought about that. I was thinking, well, what kind of dogs do they have, and what do they teach you? I mean, that's what I was thinking at the time, and then what kind of training environment, would we do training in the city or country, or what, you know, how similar of an environment was it going to be to what I was used to? So I mean, I don't disagree with what Buddy's saying at all. It's just in fact they probably should ask more questions than I did. And then of course I went, you know, my second dog I got just sort of by default because I needed to get into the school quickly because I was in at work. You know, I was working and I didn't have a lot of time, and so they were able to get me in because I was a previous student. So you want to ask questions, get as much information as you can, because that is an investment of time. And
My observation, and maybe some of these schools I see have login and maybe you get more information, but from looking at the websites from the outside, at least seven of the schools here in the States, I really didn't see a lot of useful information. So
that's because there isn't a lot of useful information on the websites. A lot of it is just there to, and it all sounds like, you know, pretty much the same from school to school. So you really have to You really have to talk to the admissions people and anybody that you can get your hands on, graduates of the program, certainly. But you're not going to get a lot just from looking at the school, because, of course, what they're all going to say, well, we have a quality breeding program. We have a quality selection program. We have quality training programs that last for X amount of time, and so on and so forth.
Right. So it's asking the question and getting a relevant or truthful answer. But because that's what I was amazed, and I was telling Tammy earlier that I found more information than anything here in the Delta Society. A lot of good tips, everything from advocacy, what happens if you're discriminated on the job or housing, or just a wealth of information. So I've linked to the website, as well as many specific links here on the page that those attending accessibleevent.com can see. And of course, those afterward will post the show notes page. Because I just think that's, have any of you had any discrimination to deal with, and how did you deal with it?
The biggest problem, I'm sure everyone will agree with me here, the biggest problem that we face in general is taxi cabs.
I actually haven't had that, oddly enough. Really? I've probably been one of the few people that have had that, not had that happen, and I've actually been prepared for it, and actually, as an odd kind of a segue here, because I'm a Muslim dog guide user, I get it from both sides, actually, because the blind people come to me and say, how come you Muslims won't let us ride in the cab? And I'm like, oh my goodness. And they get angry with me, you know, and it's like I have to kind of explain the cultural/religious dimensions behind why a Muslim cab driver may refrain. Well, I, you know, that's from, you know, a lot of the complaints, might refuse, in my opinion, wrongfully, a ride, because they believe that the dog is unclean. And I've even read accounts where they believe that just having the dog in the cab is not, they couldn't even deal with that, even if the dog was laying on a mat somewhere or to where, you know, or whatever. But then I also get it, you know, it's like, a lot of people ask, you know, why do you have to have the dog? Can you just use a cane, or can your husband take you? And so there has to be a lot of education on both sides. For for people that are blind and visually impaired who are not Muslim, to understand, you know, why this is happening, that it's not an intentional, I would dare say, I mean, even if the driver's rude, which shouldn't happen, that it's not an intentional slight, that it is a real issue for them, and they truly believe that they cannot, that they are not allowed to have this dog in the car with them. And then, of course, on the other side, there needs to be education, on the laws of the country, that whatever you believe, you cannot deny this person access, and B, from a religious perspective, that it is perfectly permissible to have the dog in the car with you. And that if a Muslim does choose to use a dog, that it is perfectly permissible for them to do so, and there's nothing, you know, nothing wrong with it. So I think there just has to be a lot of education on both sides.
Tammy, did you have anything you wanted to add on this before we go to our next question?
Actually, I thought Jenny stated it very well. Now, I don't have the Muslim crossover. I do, you know, occasionally, in fact, down at our corner store where I go occasionally, I know one of the clerks is certainly Middle Eastern and appears unthrilled by having the dog there. I would have to make assumptions about his face, but so he makes a token effort to say, no, I don't, you know, your dog can't come in here. And I say, well, she's a guide dog. And then we go on. So it's, I figured that's okay. Again, given the probability that it has to do with his faith, he does follow the law and he's not obnoxious about it. So, I do still exercise my right to go in. I have discovered that when you're renting an apartment, you can have housing issues. They might rent to you and then, and I've heard this from others, cause problems. And that can get sticky. As for how I dealt with it the first time, I would say badly. I was naive.
Yeah,
and,
I put it.
Yeah, I was a sweet, innocent young thing or something. I got it worked out, and I was relieved to be able to find a better situation to begin with, because that it was not a good company to be running from, let's say that, in the first
Right,
place.
Sometimes those things go hand in hand. So I got a link here that says, you've been denied access, now what? And it gives a lot of resources, be it housing, employment discrimination, mm-hmm. and all
those things. Yeah, employment's another big one.
I don't know, Jenny, if you want to go into any detail on that, but you did actually receive a letter from a company using that as a reason, right? Saying that you're...
Oh, yes. They actually... And like I said, I think about it, 5-6 years after the fact, and I'm still bowled over by it because they actually were, I don't want to say dumb enough, but they actually put it in the letter that they sent to me, basically thanking me for my interest in wanting to work for the company, but that their facilities weren't conducive to the presence of my guide dog. And I couldn't believe that they had actually put that in writing. I thought, oh boy, talk about handing something to you on a platter here, most times I've had incidents where I've suspected that mm-hmm. either my blindness or my dog was the issue. But, of course, the prospective employer was smart enough not to, come right out and say it. But in this situation that happened to me, oh, yes, they put it in writing and sent not only the copy to me, but sent it to my job counselor, and I think maybe even sent it to my VR counselor, too.
I'm sorry.
They sent it to a couple other people. Oh yeah, it was a big problem. For them, not for me. I mean, I couldn't believe it, and of course, then went through the process of filing a complaint with the EEOC and getting a decision a couple years later. But I think if people are going to be prepared to fight something, whether it's housing or whatever discrimination, just be prepared for a long fight. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be resolved usually within a month or 2 months or a few weeks or a few days or whatever. You got to be prepared for the fact that it's going to drag out and drag out and drag out, especially if you start getting into filing federal charges and getting it to court and if it actually gets that far. I mean, you're talking about years. So that might be something you want to consider if you're wanting to fight something like that. It's not going to be as simple as, oh, they're going to realize they're wrong, and then they'll give me what I want. It's not going to happen that way. Usually, they're going to fight it, and they're going to, do what they can to.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to open up the chat lines here, so to speak, shortly, and see what questions our participants have this evening. But one big question I want to ask the three of you is, what are the important things you need to convey to your family and friends? They may think they're being helpful or being cute, trying to sneak the dog a little piece of food or, harmless play in their mind, but actually teaching the dog some bad habits that could form distractions at inopportune times when he or she is working. So let's talk about that, either what you've learned through Hard Knocks or you were specifically told by your schools to make sure that your family members and friends aren't doing.
I think above all, the big, big thing is that they need to realize that whatever you say about what is okay and what is not okay for them to do with your dog is the final word. There is no appeal. There is no arguing. There is no nothing. What you say about what goes on with your dog is law as far as that is concerned. I think that it really boils down to that. Getting family and friends to understand that sometimes is very difficult. I'm sure all of us can identify with the fact that as blind people, we're often put in positions of an inferior position where we have no... whether it's perception or reality, where we are in an inferior position, and we really have to, in a lot of cases, we really have to just decide that we're not going to be in that position anymore. Mm-hmm. I've seen people that have, for example, come home with their dogs, and they've lived at home with their parents and so forth, and their family would say, oh, well, your dog can't sleep in the house. He has to sleep in the garage. or something like that. And that people have had to learn to put their foot down basically and say, no, look, this is my dog. This is, my means of independent travel. This is not a pet. this is not up for negotiation, and you know, the rules of how we're going to deal with this are these, and that's the end of the discussion. And that's a really difficult thing for a lot of us, I think.
Yes.
Well, luckily, I was pretty lucky in that department because I, you know, pretty much my family and friends are pretty, they're like, okay, whatever you want us to do, we'll do it. And whatever you don't want us to do, we won't. But then again, I think that goes on how, not only how you view the dog or how you view animals in general, but then how you view the person, you know, if your family views you as inferior, as he said, to start with, then it's going to hurt. It's going to you're going to have more of an uphill battle.
Right. All R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Right. Exactly.
But then I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, of course, another big thing is not only friends and family that, of course, obviously we all know, you also have to deal with the public. And sometimes, as probably you guys can attest, the public can be quite rude and quite, like, for example, no petting, no feeding. And I mean, I've had people get rude with me when I say, please do not pet my dog. And they act like, what's wrong? There's nothing, you know, they don't, you know, so that's, of course, another thing you also have to learn to put your foot down about as well, is that, you have to learn how to deal with the public in that way, and that sometimes you can't be nice all the time. And of course, sometimes as blind people, we're taught, well, you have to, you have to be nice and not be rude because you don't want to, you know, whatever. But then when it's regards your dog, you really have to be, I don't want to say mean, but you really have to be very assertive sometimes, because you've got people that will be downright, they just don't care. They'll look right past you, you know, and just be looking at the dog, and you say, please do not do X, Y, or Z. And they think it's a game. They're like, well, and then they yell at you, and like, well, there's, what's wrong with that? You know, so.
Well, there you go. You got to talk to them, maybe like you do the dog once in a while. Quiet.
Sorry about that.
Hands off.
Grace, I forgot the consequences of breaking the routine around here.
Yeah. I had with my sister. Someone asked me if they could pet my dog, and I said, no, you can't pet him right now. And my sister told me that I was very rude with that person.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you have to be a lot nicer to people, and you have to explain why they can't. It's like, no, I don't have
time
to. I don't
to
have to explain anything.
Right. I wondered if you get a canned answer, 10 words or less, I'm sorry you can't pet him while he's working. It could distract him from his job or whatever.
Yeah, that's what you do. Because sometimes you're running, you know, I've had times where I'm running to class or running to get to somewhere, and they want to stop and talk. And it's like, hey, I have to go. I don't have time to, or the situation happens so fast. I had someone, I was trying to ask for directions, and instead of them telling me, they actually grabbed the side of my first dog's harness and pulled her. I could actually hear her nails, you know, scraping the sidewalk. And before I could even react, I said, don't you dare touch my dog. And I had to do it because they had my dog by the harness and was dragging her.
And I said,
don't you do that. I said, you tell me where you want me to go. I said, I don't, you know, I was just shocked. So I just reacted sort of by instinct. And my dad was like, well, you shouldn't have done that. I said, Dad, they had my dog by the side of the harness and was dragging her, you know, across the sidewalk.
Yeah, at that point, I mean, you have to. Tammy, I wanted to ask you, as a trainer, I did a show back in 99 called Handy Talk, and I've asked quite a few people since, and no one has ever agreed with this, but her take was there were only two people foods that you could feed your animal. And her thought was broccoli and carrots. So I'm curious, is there any people/human food that would be acceptable to give to a dog? And if so, what would that be?
Well, I know there is a long list of people foods that are toxic to animals, you know, chocolate, onions, garlic, and so we don't do that. Now, carrots can make good training treats, actually, because they're low-cal and the dogs like them. When my dog was young, if I even thought about giving her people food, it got ugly. and then she outgrew that.
So are you saying basically no, just stay away from that and just to...
From people food?
Yes.
We will occasionally share people food with our dogs, but on a very limited basis. And my dog seems to be able to generalize to the limit. And when I say we, usually it's that is one thing with my roommate. But I have never really put my foot down with the feeding of the dog, because it hasn't affected her behavior at work, and he does it in an intelligent way. He's not just loading her down with steaks and so forth. But we do try to stay away from breads and potato chips and popcorn and, you know, that kind of people food. But say, raw meat, that sort of thing, we will give nibbles to both of our dogs. One has allergies, so we're motivated to be careful. And then as far as what I prefer with her, and especially when she was younger during training, I used specific training treats. And then her diet, which I watched very carefully. I wanted her to grow up to be a good, strong, healthy, long-lived dog. So I don't know. As far as, yeah, what we do feed or what I think is okay, I tend to think it depends on your dog's health and appetite. And I know many people are very rigid about ever feeding people food. I'm more lax because I feel it's I can get away with it, but that doesn't mean I, you know, have her eat off my plate. Does that make sense?
I'm pretty rigid myself.
Well, I think you should be. Now, I read the book from the NLS, supposedly the real Dog Whisperer or whatever, not the imitation TV show, but
the guy.
Yeah, and it was making some points about, I wonder if these carry over the same things like you always should eat first and then let the dog eat, or you always walk through the door first. And there's this whole thing about the dog knowing who's master, and does all this come into play, or is that just kind of a, are they out in left field, or is the rules for guide dogs a little different?
Well, with the guide dog, they usually walk through the door first.
That's why I asked that. Yeah, I think that.
Yes, and I think I try to be aware of pack behavior stuff, and especially living now with the second dog and our family. We joke that, you know, our dogs run the house, but there's a certain amount of where that behavior does communicate to the dog. And then I also have a friend who says, well, I don't worry about it too much because I'm in charge because I expect them to be in charge. So there can be a lot of subtlety in the communication.
What about like the food element saying, well, I'm going to eat, we're going to eat first and you eat after we do. Does that matter?
That's a new one. I've never heard of that.
You never heard of that?
I've heard that, but well, I'm not sure I buy completely.
I usually don't eat at the same time my dog wants to eat.
Well, no. So,
and we don't have a problem. Like except for a few instances when she decides that she wants to try to get away with something. Generally, I can leave my food unattended for, you know, short periods of time. Like if I have to step out of the room and I'm still eating, I can leave my food and she just stays. Peanut butter seems to be my dog's particular vice, actually. I sometimes have to be careful because she'll decide that she wants to have a treat. If I have a peanut butter, she stole my peanut butter sandwich twice on me, and I've had her for 2.5 years.
Well, let's hope you don't have peanut butter cups. Maybe keep those away.
Oh,
the chocolate would be bad.
Well, yeah. I had her steal a little small piece of chocolate, and thank goodness it wasn't the dark, deep, dark baker's chocolate, and we didn't have any issues, thankfully. But done that before. So, but I mean, again, that goes back to, obviously, if you have a dog, I think the relationship between a dog and their handler, as far as a guide dog situation, is a little bit different than a pet/human situation.
Right.
And sometimes you have to be the leader, i.e. you got to tell the dog where to go, but then sometimes your dog's got to make a decision and assume the leadership role. If you're in a situation that the dog, you know, like for example, has to stop for the car coming down the road, or has to stop for a curb, or has to take you around an obstacle, the dog actually has to, in a way, to step up and serve a leadership purpose. And I think that's why our dogs are kind of a step above most. I mean,
Seen that too, where I've seen new people with their dogs and they're second guessing each other, and that's part of, I guess, that 6 months to a year bond.
Yeah.
You learn when to trust a dog.
Well, I don't know about these other two fine young ladies over here, but I still second, you know, even towards the end, I would still second guess my dog now and then. I think we all do it, but
I think sometimes it happens to the best of us. Even if you've had your dog, even with my first dog I worked with for 10 years, sometimes your dog just has a day where they're just goofing off. I mean, they're distracted and they're doing their own thing, and you can tell. You just learn, again, that's part of the bonding process, is learning to tell the difference. I've actually also had times where my dog really wasn't goofing off. And
you thought they were? Yep.
Oh, yeah, and that's when you want to know.
Yeah, I had a house fire once.
I do. I want to stop you just a second just to let folks know I have enabled the text questions and the live voice chat. So, again, if you have a question, just simply press F9 and state your first name and release, and then we'll call on you in turn. Likewise, you have the text or audio questions. I think I would prefer text if you didn't mind, but we certainly can do audio. Or if you are going to do an audio question, please try to be very concise to it because we are running out of time here, and I want to make sure we cover as much material as possible. But I'm sorry.
I think the bottom line here is that even though the relationship is different, there are certainly boundaries that we need to set with our dogs. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, yeah.
Like the dog whisperer on TV always says rules, boundaries, and limitations. And at least on that aspect of it, I would agree with him on that because, I mean, obviously, if you let your dog just run around the house and do whatever they want, they're going to completely lose they're just going to lose it. You know, they're not going to even be dog guides anymore. You know, they're going to just be pets. You let them get away with everything.
And bad pets at that.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Okay, well, like I said, the text chat is open, and of course, F9 is your talk key, so it's okay because there is a couple second difference between what we're saying and what you hear, so you may have to kind of jump in there. That's why I just say press F9 and just state your name or something, and then we can call on you there. What about airport travel? That's become a big point of, and I know some say, well, as long as the number one thing is just be emphatic on never allow the agents or anyone to separate you from your dog. But there are also some guidelines, I think, that some people have been known to print out. And there's even an ADA card, one of the links I have here, that people can have conveniently available with their rights and so forth. But have any of you had airport security issues?
Yes.
Yes. I thought I was prepared, but I just one point going through security to catch a flight after using the relieving area. They broke all the rules, and so did I. And anyway, I learned something. There was an offered cavity search of my dog, though, which didn't fly. I did put my foot down on that. I'm not kidding. The guy was snapping on gloves. And I had no idea what to say. I was, just thinking, okay, we'll just cooperate. We'll go with it. You know, this too shall pass, whatever. I was at the end of a long convention and, half sleepwalking. But when he started snapping on gloves and said, well, we'll have to do a cavity search of the dog, I just looked at him and he decided not to. Yeah, it wasn't going to happen. But at that point, I was suddenly wide awake and not going with the flow. Like, I don't care who you are. I learned something and, and now it's, I can look back and laugh.
So what do we need to know when traveling internationally? I know, Jenna, you went to Africa, right? You took either a current or past dog to Africa?
No, I didn't take Chloe. I took my first dog. You would need to learn. Now, of course, I did this pre 9/11, so I don't know what kind of issues you'd have coming back. I really didn't have any issues going. The country itself, you have to find out if they have any special requirements as far as getting the dog into the particular country that you're going. And then also coming back, you have to make sure that, to see if there may be any issues coming back with your dog from a particular place. But then I took, also you want to make sure that you carry their health documentation with you. And any type of information showing that they're a service animal, obviously you do that anyway. But you don't just want to. It's not like traveling between states or probably even into Canada. It's a lot more involved, and you want to make sure that. And also, if you're traveling internationally, depending on where you're going, you might have to pack extra food for the dog because they're not going to always have the food that you need. And of course, you also want to see what, take whatever meds they need. Just like for people, make sure you take their heartworm and flea medication and whatever they have, and be aware of what the conditions are to the best of your ability as to where you're going, to see if it's safe for the dog even to be there, so that'd be some of my recommendations, because even international travel, even for people, is a lot more involved than regular travel just around the U.S. So it's the same with traveling with your dog. You just have to make sure that you're prepared as best you can be, and that the dog is And you have to decide maybe it's better to leave the dog or not.
Tammy, I wanted to ask you, because a lot of people interchange guide dog with service animal, and I got a link here that says the difference between guide dogs, service, or maybe I should read it verbatim here, the difference between service, therapy, companion, and social therapy animal. So talk about that a little bit, because they're dogs used for many other purposes than just assisting the blind.
Right. And a guide dog is a specialized kind of service dog. A service dog is one who is specially trained to mitigate a disability. And of course, with a blind person, that's pretty obvious what they do. Or even with the hearing alert dog, I think those two people relate to more. So service animal, well, really under the ADA, and that's usually where it becomes important as far as your access right goes.
Right, because it says these therapy animals don't necessarily have a right to take them in public, so they may help you in the home environment, but that doesn't mean you can take them to the restaurant to cope with people in the public and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, my understanding of a therapy dog, now that's a dog that you take, say, to a hospital to visit people, or perhaps if maybe you have a child with autism or something, you might then have the dog, you know, specifically to provide therapy for the child, but it's more the dog is helping someone maybe feel better or heal. So usually they're the kind of dogs that they go to visit the nursing home.
Or I've heard of even cats
or cats, other animals, right? Sorry, I think dog. It's a matter of use. A companion animal, and I may be wrong, the definitions are changing somewhat. The companion animal is, I think, pretty much now called an emotional assist. Emotional support.
Yeah, a social.
And that means
social therapy animals, by definition, are usually animals that did not complete service animal or service dog training due to health or disposition. So they're made available for pets, for people who have disabilities. So even though they don't meet the definition of service animals. But anyway, that's a link we put up there. I was just...
Right, and that's actually a new one on me. So I'll have to check the link and find out more.
So I guess just going back to service animals. So you have guide dogs for the blind, but you also have dogs for the deaf to alert them if someone's come to the door. Of course, they have other devices as well, fans and lights and things, but... Animals that can alert them, or maybe people who are confined to a wheelchair can have animals to do certain things, or they drop something on the floor, or, you know, so there's some different applications.
Right. And I think actual medical alert dogs also count as service animals, although you other two can correct me if I'm wrong on that. The key, as far as access, again, legally, is that they're specifically trained to perform a task. So say our Daisy, who if you hear really loud, that will be her. She detected my roommate's throat cancer before I ever met him. And in fact, that was why he got early diagnosis and is now fine.
Wow.
But she was not trained to do that, so we can't take her into the store and say, oh, she's a medical alert dog. Even though she, you know, did alert him to a serious medical issue.
And how did she do that?
It was a throat cancer, and she would sniff his throat and whine and cry, and then she tried to bite it.
Wow.
And at one point, so he went to his doctor and said, look, check it out, and they did, and it was very early stages, and they wouldn't have caught it otherwise. So.
Wow, fascinating. Or for epilepsy, I understand some folks have... then some retraining of their dogs because they may be blind, but also prone to seizures.
They can redirect, like they can take an innate ability to detect that and teach it a specific behavior, as well as to maybe say, for example, use something to call for help and then sort of keep that person safe, so in case they fall or something like that.
They can alert, make a certain sound saying you're about to have a seizure, and yes, even call for help on the phone and or have a device. which I always find amazing. I don't know how to train for that, so I think it's
That's the thing.
Cool.
Sometimes they do stuff they're not trained for. I mean, like I said, I was in a house fire once, and my dog, my first dog, I thought she had to go to the bathroom, and she was jumping on me and barking at me, and I thought, man, I better hurry up and take her out. And the fire was in the attic, and we think what happened was she could either hear it or smell it or both. And she made a somehow in her mind, in her brain, made a decision that this is not right, and I need to get her out of the house. And I walked out. And I was outside, and of course, at the first, I was like, why aren't you doing anything? And then, of course, the neighbors came and told me that there was smoke coming out of my house. That's how that happened. So yeah, sometimes they will make decisions, and again, this just goes to show how wonderful these animals really are, and how they really are kind of the cream of the crop as far as the how they're put together, you know, the breeding and the training and everything. Because sometimes they will just step up and do things that they weren't not trained. No one, how do you train for that? You can't train for something like that. But then they've made the decision that something is wrong, and they need to. Again, maybe it's in their mind part of the guiding process that, okay, there is danger, i.e. whether it's a car or an obstacle, and again, a safety, you know, issue that they need to kind of get their owner away from. And so sometimes, but you hear stories like that a lot with dog guides where they've done things like that.
Yeah, or they've changed, they know, like that their owner or master or whatever has gone under, you know, into surgery because their behavior changes, they know.
Yeah.
Just amazing things.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, even though I'm on my second dog, it still amazes me what both of my dogs do or have done. And they weren't necessarily even though they are trained for it, sometimes it just amazes me what they remember and or what they pick up on. And so they're just amazing animals. So.
Well, we're down to about 5 minutes. Certainly, if anyone has any text questions, by all means, submit those or F9 as you push to talk. And maybe time to see if there's any final comments or anything particular that we haven't addressed yet that any of the three of you feel is important and that you want to convey, because, you know, it's a big decision and people need to think it through very carefully. It is a change in their lifestyle and their time. They can't just take off for days and days at a time without making plans or assuming that either the dog is going to be a part of that or when it comes time for retirement. You know, what they're going to do with the animal, that's got to be a very tough...
That's a tough one.
Yes,
it
is. I was fortunate that I was able to keep my first dog and also my second. I don't know if I'll be able to keep Chet now once I get dog number three or not. I don't know yet, but...
Well, I was lucky as well because my first dog went to my parents. That was kind of just an unspoken. Although people asked me, I always joked that there was going to be a custody battle over my dog because everybody wanted her when she retired.
That's about right.
Yeah.
And, I was lucky that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, buddy.
I was going to say that's a hard thing, but in summary, the whole thing, you know, it's a lot of responsibility. Yeah, it's a lifestyle change to an extent. But I'd say it's more than a fair trade if you ask me.
I would say the same thing. It's more than worth it. I mean, it really is. I had to go back to using a cane for a while after I retired my first dog because there was just a lag between moving, you know, being in the middle of a move and then going back and getting my second dog. I mean, to me personally, you have to make your own decision, but I really think there's just the difference between using a cane and using a dog is like night and day. I mean, there's
absolutely.
So the two things there is...
I'm still doing it, and I got to tell you, I like I said before, I don't have any problem going anywhere I want, doing anything that I want, but it's not as much fun. It's more of a pain. It's more of a bother.
Yeah.
More work.
It's more work, yeah. And So I put things off until I have to, and you know, whereas when I had the dog, it's like, okay, I need to go and do something. All right, let's go.
Yeah.
That's a good point because, you know, so people have to weigh all that out. I'm curious, I guess two things I'm thinking of here. One is, A, obviously you have to stay up on your cane skills.
Yes.
Because you never know anything. Your dog,
you never know.
Well, in transition, but your dog could become sick and be down for a little while. So anything could happen. Could be hurt out in the field. Oh, I know. I wanted to ask about what are some necessary supplies? I mean, what you know, how much do you need to plan on spending? I mean, even if the dog is free, which isn't cheap to the people who invest in that, and mm-hmm. your travel to and from the school. But what are you talking about on a monthly or annual basis, just between food and harness and veterinary bills and so forth?
Oh, boy.
I haven't ever added it up either, really, but food is a good one. You probably better expect to pay more to spend more than what you'd buy the dad's dog food and gravel from the grocery store. You might not expect to pay more because you want to feed something that actually has nutritional value. Also, you know, you're looking at annual vet costs. Let's see, with shots and checkup and everything, you know, $100 or $200 a year.
Yeah,
minimum.
I think that's what it costs. I think last
someone
time
said,
it was around...
Someone said kind of average out about 50 a month, which would be 600 a year, meaning between everything.
Yeah, I'd say that'd be right.
I think that's pretty close.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, unless you hit some very extraordinary medical expenses or something like that, yeah, I guess that would be about right.
Well, that's
maybe
where working
more.
Out something with your vet comes in. I know one thing that Leader Dog recommends is that maybe you could have a discussion with your vet about, like my vet that I go to gives me a, like the office visits are free and the office care is free, but then I have a 5% discount on any meds and shots. So like if I need her nails trimmed, I don't feel comfortable trimming my dog's nails. I know some people do it, but I don't really feel comfortable myself. So I just run her in for a trim, and it doesn't cost anything for me because that she's a dog guide. Now, unfortunately, if we were to have anything really catastrophic happen, I would hope that, I haven't really asked him this, but I would hope that we could work something out. But that would be something you might want to discuss with your veterinarian or a potential veterinarian as to what you would, you know, how you would handle that or what the pricing arrangements could be, especially since a lot of people who are blind and visually impaired who might want a dog are on fixed incomes. So they don't have hundreds and hundreds of dollars to spend at the vet.
But you shouldn't go with the vet just on the sole basis of will I get a discount.
Referrals and making sure you get someone who's truly
saying that, Jenny. Right. I'm just saying that that's something that you have to really keep in mind. My vet, for example, doesn't give me nothing, but they are very good about, you know, letting me pay stuff off if I need to, you know, pay stuff, you know, they'll let me post day checks and that sort of thing, and that's good. But
that's nice.
We're actually right at the hour mark, but I have to ask this at least this one other question, and then how do you know and determine it's time to retire your animal?
Ooh,
that's a toughie.
See, the it's a really lame answer, okay? But you just know, and it's never the same.
Yeah.
It's never the same. My first dog, for example, he had this bladder infection, and the bladder infection just would not go away. And one day I got his harness out and get ready to go somewhere, and Melanie says, "Yeah, he's just standing across the room, just looking at you, kind of like, do I have to go?" And, you know, I knew then it was time. And a week after I retired him, his bladder infection cleared up. Chet, on the other hand, it was a little bit more difficult. He still wants to go. He doesn't necessarily want to work, but he still wants to go. but he just started slowing down, which gave him more of an opportunity to get distracted by other dogs and so forth. And then, you know, being in the car longer in about half an hour, he'd start getting real anxious. And so it's like, okay, he's not really safe anymore. So I think it's probably time now. So, you know, you just sometimes they tell you, and sometimes it's just you have to make a decision that, okay, he's not safe, even if he wants to still go. But
it's just one of those things you do know, and then you just make a decision.
So it's performance, right? Missing cues, or like I said, just slowing down, or just more distracted,
sometimes.
Or could be health issues.
Could be health.
Or, yeah.
But and sometimes you know, but you don't want to know.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That was. I guess that's where I was going with it. You might know and think, but you know, he's still so young, and you know, and I don't know how long people live in that kind of denial, or it may vary between persons, or maybe they have something a little happens to awaken them that wow, this is more serious than I thought. Maybe.
Yeah, and I haven't been through it, so I always listen to others because you want to make the right decision for both of you.
I actually slowly retired my first dog because I noticed that like she could do short runs to the store or to work or whatever, but then she couldn't if we went on a long trip or we traveled, that really, as she got older, really tired her out. So I did the thing where I decided, okay, well, when if I have to travel, I'll leave you with my mom or my brother. And she didn't seem to mind that, you know, but then, you know, if I want to go to the store or go on a walk, I'll take you on a short. And then it just sort of was for me, it just wasn't a all-out retirement right away with her. It was kind of a slow decline from, okay, we won't work as much. And just sort of, it wasn't just a quitting cold turkey, so to speak. It was just, you know, slowly we just stopped working. So that's what I
probably a good idea. We've surpassed our hour, so I'm just going to let you have quick final comments here, and we'll put the wraps on Tech Chat 60, of course, made possible through the Technology of Accessible event from Cerotech Corporation. So hope you'll check that out if you need it to do a class, lecture, seminar, or just have a discussion like this at accessibleevent.com. But one final round of quick comments from each of you, if we can. We'll start with you, Tammy.
Well, I
or you can. Give your contact
I have now
info
forgotten the one I was thinking of earlier when Jennifer was saying something. Oh, about the amazingness of the dogs. I think that is one of the really rewarding things about working with a guide dog and as an owner trainer, because like she says, they are the cream of the crop. Their work involves responsiveness and in that sense obedience, following a large number of commands that half the time I forget them. However, they have to make decisions about things that aren't dog type, you know, they decision making and have to be willing to argue with you sometimes. And so one thing I have enjoyed about being an owner trainer is seeing that development in my dog, as I've been learning to bring that along in her, along with the task training, and I think that has been it's very rewarding in being an owner trainer, and it's fun to watch, and then to get to meet others and their guide dogs, and know
definitely
see
and
more
I guess
how the dogs actually work.
Right,
yes.
I guess the two things is A. You know, you as a user have to use your instincts, and even if that means going to a school and 2 weeks into it going, hey, this is not for me, instead of feeling like, oh, I've got to go through with this, better to, you know, say, this is not for me, give the animal back. Maybe some other student can acclimate and use because there's a lot of money and time involved, and that dog's life is dedicated to that purpose. But Jenny, any final thoughts from you?
Well, pretty much, you know, having a dog is, as I said, it's a big decision. But, you know, it's if someone does decide to have a dog or to get a dog, it is definitely worth it. You hopefully, as you know, as long as the dog is healthy, you'll have a very rewarding experience.
And you, buddy?
Yeah, what they said, basically.
You know what they
yeah, what they said. No, no, really. Like I said before, you know, yes, it's a responsibility. Sometimes it's a lot of work. Sometimes it's a lot of heartache when they go through, you know, being sick or whatever. But man, it's really a more than an even trade. I think it's definitely worth any of the stuff that you have to go through to have it. It really is. And you know, if it's something that you're thinking about, definitely, you know, give it serious thought. It is a big decision. It's a life changing decision. But you know. And don't be afraid to ask other guide dog users for help or advice or whatever.
Definitely.
Oh, right. It's. I have not run across anything that I thought was too weird even to ask about to find out that, you know, the real experts, the longtime users, have been there, done that, and always are willing to talk to you. And
I guess I wondered what to do when you saw someone was, I don't want to say abusing, but really just not using their dog correctly. I heard a story of a lady whose dog was eating out of the trash can. And, of course, I was at a convention. This woman hit me head on with her dog. And then she was like, oh, no, that's bad. You shouldn't do that. And I just didn't feel it was a proper discipline. And you know what? Yeah, well, my mouth is bleeding, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, that's not right. And, you know, should I take a little more action, contact the school or say, hey, you know, this is she's a danger to herself or whatever, you know? I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, I want to thank all of you for your input tonight. I think it will be very useful to many people as they make that important decision and decide. And, of course, you can send us your comments and suggestions to resources at serotalk.com. And, of course, there's a show notes page that you can get to through serotalk.com, or if you want the direct URL, it is serotalk.com/show notes/guidedog.htm. And inviting you to join us next week, May 6th, our topic is the iPad. We'll be learning about this new and exciting device. That is one of the first devices that allows you to see a web page, or at least many web pages, the way they are really designed. You can see it just like the sighted folks do. So when they say click in the upper right-hand corner, you know where that is. So we think that'll be an exciting topic. Also, later on in May, on the 27th, we'll be talking about Office 2010 coming out and what's new and cool, or what's same old, but all that coming up for you. So until we meet again next week, this is Michael Off inviting all of you to stay connected and stay directed. This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.